You're listening to Asia Pac Unwrapped, first broadcast on the 14th of June 2015 on Monocle 24. Asia Pac Unwrapped, in association with ANZ. Hello and welcome to edition number 7 of Asia Pac Unwrapped, in association with ANZ on Monocle 24. Produced from our studios in Tokyo, Hong Kong and Singapore, and at Midori House right here in London, this is your unmissable weekly briefing from the world's most dynamic region. I'm your host, Ben Ryland. Coming up on today's show, we'll cross to Bangkok to hear about Thailand's largest retail conglomerate taking a leap into the German luxury department store market. Also ahead, Monocle's Singapore Bureau Chief Nolan Giles runs through this year's MasterCard Global Cities Index.
It's really about a shift in priorities, more about experiences, and the world is getting smaller. It's a cliche, but these numbers really bear it out.
And we cross to Hong Kong to hear about what makes a modern luxury property worthy of the title.
There's an increasing opportunity, particularly for the uber wealthy who regard property as a new asset class. And so a lot of investment has been driven to property here, but also in Australia, US, or in Europe.
We'll also hear from our Tokyo bureau about a new cruise ship terminal opening up even more potential in the city of Fukuoka. And later in the show, we're asking why the art of curating specialist cinema in a 1930s single-screen picture palace still makes good business sense in Melbourne's vibrant art scene.
Being able to see a classic film on the largest screen possible in a single-screen auditorium has an air of prestige about it, and it honours the film work. So I think, you know, if you're a lover of cinema, being able to be engaged with the single-screen location is really important.
All that right here on Asia Pac Unwrapped, in association with ANZ on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Ryland, and this is Asia Pac Unwrapped, where we take a closer look at the world's most dynamic region and explore emerging opportunities, whether it's places to invest, the finest destinations for a well-deserved break, or inspiring stories from the region's smartest business people. We're taking off to Thailand first with a look ahead at the week in numbers. Gwen Robinson is Senior Asia Editor at Nikkei Asian Review and Monocle's correspondent in Bangkok. She joins me now on the line. Gwen, one of the largest retail groups in Asia has sent ripples through the international retail world after buying a stake in three luxury department stores in Germany. Tell us more about that one.
Actually, Central is probably the biggest retailer, maybe perhaps in the region, at least one of, and it's rapidly becoming one of the biggest in the world, I think. They've started with a family-run company, steadily opening stores of different sorts. But their flagship retail operations centre on very big, very multifaceted department stores. There's several in Bangkok and replicated around Thailand. But in some recent years, they've actually gone out into Europe, snapping up La Rinascente, which is one of the Italian, slightly more upmarket department stores. They then made acquisitions in Denmark about 2 years ago. And most recently, we've just heard this past week that they've scooped up one of Germany's oldest and biggest department stores, a group called Kadewe, which has three signature department stores, quite old, very well known and very centrally located. So that's a very interesting strategy for a Thai group, because most Thai retailers are very much focused on the domestic market.
And Gwen, how is this likely to be digested at home in Thailand? Can we expect to see any splashing about in the market?
Well, it's interesting because investors are actually not a huge influence on what Central does. They're a close family-held company, but with a vast web of different companies encompassing real estate and convenience stores, etc. But only a handful of the companies in that group are listed. So, you know, it's very much a family controlled concern, which seems very focused on pushing the boundaries of retail and getting out there in the world. As far as what it means, how it impacts operations, or what it means about Thailand, I think, again, you know, this is actually quite a smart move, given that under the military-backed government here in Thailand, following the coup in May last year, there's some concerns about consumer confidence. Spending has gone down. There's a slightly, you know, apprehensive air. I wouldn't say fearful, because this junta seems just like, or at least even less draconian than previous ones. Life continues very much as normal, but household debt levels are continuing to mount, and more importantly, export figures are going down for Thailand. So I think Central and other savvy retailers have probably correctly surmised that they're not going to get a whole lot more upside in the foreseeable future on Thai consumer spending. Why not go to Europe? Why not apply their quite impressive techniques and strategies that they've played in Asia, in Europe? And they're very influenced by things like Japanese retail. Their department stores are incredibly well-ordered and always interesting. They're always innovating. And I think, it, you know, European consumer is probably ready for some fresh retail approaches, as evidenced by what Central has done in Italy and Denmark, which is change, add interesting twist to a very traditional retail culture of Italy and Denmark. So that will be very closely watched and interesting to see what the group does do with these sort of revered old German retail empires.
Now, just stepping over the border to Burma now, Gwen, there's been a flood of license applications submitted in the lead up to the opening of the stock market there. The start date has actually been put on hold. What's the story there?
Myanmar has been opening very steadily since 2011, when this current government came to power in the first kind of pseudo-democratic election. And they have instituted a raft of reforms, but the real goal that they had for this year was to launch the country's first stock market. It was slated for around October. They'd initially pushed for July. It's far too ambitious. A lot of analysts and investors in Myanmar felt that way too. They were warned, but there was a lot of push to get this off the ground before, it might be said, the next election, which is supposed to be in November. And I think this government wanted to show that it's actually done something, you know, leave it as a legacy, the first stock market. However, it does seem there was so much interest that it seems they've been flooded with applications from brokers or people who want to start brokerages. I mean, there's no such thing up to now as a Burmese broker, because it wasn't a stock market. But I think a lot of financial or financially related companies, small banks, want to set up brokerages. So I think, though, this might be a little bit of an excuse. Clearly, the whole system and the country is not quite ready to launch into a fully functioning stock market within the next 2 or 3 months. I'd say realistically that we'd probably see it within next year.
We'll leave it there, Gwen. Thanks for joining us. Gwen Robinson there, Senior Asia Editor at Nikkei Asian Review and Monocle's correspondent in Bangkok. Coming up next, we'll take a look at some of the top-ranking consumer hotspots to watch on this year's MasterCard Global Cities Index. I'm Ben Ryland, and this is Asia Pack Unwrapped, in association with ANZ. MasterCard's annually released Global Destination Cities Index draws on independent travel data to comprehensively rank 132 cities based on visitor numbers and spending. This year's index has just been released, and while London topped the list, five Asian cities have made up the top 10. Monocle's Singapore Bureau Chief Nolan Giles caught up with Eric Schneider, MasterCard Advisors Group Head for Asia Pacific, to discuss how the index reflects the region's burgeoning tourism industry. And he started by asking Eric just who it is keeping an eagle eye on those rankings.
This is the sort of information that will be of great interest to a number of different types of players in the market, starting with governments, right? You know, whether it's cities or broader national governments relating to tourism boards, tourism bureaus, cities that are looking into their infrastructure developments, marketing type of companies, retailers, airlines, hotels. This is all very valuable information in terms of understanding who their customers are in the broadest sense.
So we're looking at the 2015 report here, and we've got London at the top of the list, but Bangkok is hot on its heels. Can you tell us, you know, what's happening in Bangkok?
It's not really a surprise. Bangkok has been chasing London for a number of years now. And really, with 18.2 million visitors, in the last year, it's a staggering number. Just think about it. That's three times the population of Singapore and then some, all going to Bangkok in the course of 1 year. Chasing London, by the way, I should add, growing more quickly at 8% versus London 6% in the next couple of years. If nothing else happens, everything is the same. You can see Bangkok in the number one position. You know, a question that comes up is often around the politics of what's going on in Thailand post-coup and so forth. You know, what I see here is nothing but upside, right? If this is how Bangkok performs with any sort of political turbulence as a backdrop, imagine what the upside is when all of that is a distant memory. You know, and that's also something that I think you can say about one of the great surprises that we see in the index in the last year is Colombo, Sri Lanka, right? I mean, if you want to talk about a peace dividend, Colombo has been, and Sri Lanka as a whole, has really been reaping that peace dividend with 21%+ growth in visitors since 2009. So while I don't think, Thailand is about, it's not about political issues blocking anything, it's about opportunity going forward, certainly peace pays a dividend.
And looking at the list, we've got five here that are Asian cities. Is that just to do with the proximity and how close everything is, or is there really, you know, a big boom going on here with tourism and people traveling between cities in Asia?
Again, I can't see into the crystal ball and can't say with 100% certainty, but if I stand back and I look at this, this is the fastest growing part of the world. I think The Economist just said that by 2050, something like 2/3 of all of the world's middle class will be in Asia Pacific. It's already over 50% at this point. This is about the fact that you are seeing not just the Chinese, who I just mentioned, having their middle class and level of affluence and, you know, inquisitiveness about the rest of the world growing rapidly, but you're also seeing countries like Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand itself, Vietnam, and other large economies in this part of the world that are not only growing at a much healthier clip than the rest of the world economy, but very specifically the tourism economy globally, but especially in this part of the world, is growing that much more faster than global economic growth as a whole. It's really about a shift in priorities, more about experiences, and people are just, the world is getting smaller, as we've been saying. It's a cliche, but these numbers really bear it out.
That was Monocle's Singapore Bureau Chief Nolan Giles there, in conversation with Eric Schneider. You're listening to Asia Pac Unwrapped, in association with ANZ. You're listening to Asia Pac Unwrapped on Monocle 24, in association with ANZ. Now, the word luxury is thrown around quite a bit these days, from luxury boutique hotels to so-called luxury desserts in the frozen food section at the supermarket. But one name has a fairly solid track record when it comes to determining whether something truly ranks among the world's most luxurious properties. Christie's has just released Luxury Defined, its 2015 analysis of the global luxury property market. Zach Wright is the Senior Vice President of Christie's, and he popped into Monocle's Hong Kong Bureau to run us through this year's report.
It's a very exciting time in residential real estate. The year 2014 set a number of records globally, both for velocity of sales and for new benchmarks in sales. We see a continuation of Asian buyers the world over, and that's impacted not only by their desire to be elsewhere, but by new governmental regulations. Sometimes it makes it very lucrative for Asians, particularly Chinese, to buy elsewhere. The Asian market here is quite a bit different than that abroad. Chinese, of course, are eager to invest in other markets for a number of reasons. They want to invest for financial reasons, but also in order to get a visa. And so there are certain governmental regulations in places like Portugal that make it very attractive. Even in the U.S., where we now have a 10-year visa, that makes it much easier for a Chinese person to buy in the U.S. The majority of Asian buyers are looking for investment. Chinese understand property, whether it's in the U.S., wherever it may be. But there is an increasing opportunity, particularly for the uber wealthy, who regard property as a new asset class, if you will. With interest rates as low as they are, it makes sense to invest in property. And so a lot of investment has been driven to property, both here, but also in markets like Australia, the US, or in Europe. The Chinese today are the number one buyers of premium vineyards the world over, whether it be in Bordeaux or in Napa Valley. The Chinese are the number one buyers. They love wine, and sometimes that's a great way for them to invest overseas. Also, they're interested in learning more about wine, as they sometimes bring vines back to China and are creating many great vineyards in China. So that's just one area that's a great opportunity to invest in. Places like Portugal, where they can get a golden visa quite easily. There are a number of ways that they can do that, but a relatively low property investment will get them a Euro visa that they can travel virtually any place in Europe. So that's a great opportunity. A traditional market for the Chinese has been Vancouver in Canada or Toronto. With the depressed Canadian dollar today, and also housing prices that lag behind the rest of the world, it's a tremendous opportunity. Vancouver Island, Victoria, the capital of British Columbia, represents a great investment. Vancouver itself, the Chinese are returning in great numbers to Vancouver. The hottest luxury property market in the world last year was Toronto. The properties were moving at a faster clip than anywhere else. We deal with all Asians, and each market has its own feeder market. Hawaii, for example, is fed by the Japanese. But today we see the Chinese going there like we never have before. Most big properties that turn today, whether it sells to a Chinese or not, there's Chinese interest in the property. But we don't see the other countries, we don't view them nearly like we do the Chinese.
That was Zach right there, the Senior Vice President of Christie's in Hong Kong. This is AsiaPac Unwrapped on Monocle 24 in association with ANZ. I'm Ben Rylan. Now, the shores of Japan are becoming increasingly attractive to avid ocean cruisers, with about 416,000 foreign visitors flocking to the country by boat last year. And combined with domestic tourism, the city of Fukuoka attracts about 17 million visitors every year. The Japanese government is hoping to increase visitor numbers going into next year, so it's unsurprising that Fukuoka's current cruise ship terminal might be looking a bit outdated. Well, joining me now on the line from our Tokyo bureau is Monocle's Asia Editor-at-Large, Kenji Hall. Kenji, first up, give us a bit of background on what's pushed the construction of Fukuoka's new terminal.
Well, first of all, let's start off by talking about Fukuoka's Hakata port. This is Japan's number one port for tourists arriving by boat from overseas. It's been number one for the past two decades. Fukuoka gets about 17.8 million visitors a year, of which around 2 million arrive by sea. The problem has always been that even though we've seen an increase in the number of visitors to Fukuoka coming by ship, we haven't actually seen an increase in the facilities. We haven't seen an improvement in the facilities in Fukuoka to accommodate all those people. Last year, there were 99 port calls by cruise ships in Fukuoka, and they brought 420,000 tourists, and that was a record. This year, the number of port calls will be more than double that. And so this terminal is perfectly timed to accommodate the sharp increase in the number of visitors by ship.
So Kenji, what is behind the rising number of people flocking to Fukuoka?
Well, I think if you look at the cruise ship business in general, what we've seen is we've seen rising incomes in Asia leading to more demand for luxury travel. And cruise ship travelers have been on the increase in Asia. It's still a very small part of the global business for cruise travelers, but it's growing rapidly.
And Kenji, you say visitor numbers in Fukuoka are expected to increase. What impact is that likely to have on the city?
Well, first of all, let me talk about the terminal itself. It cost about 900 million Japanese yen. That's about 6.4 million euros. It's not a huge amount of money. So for this relatively small investment, the city will get a proper facility. What we've seen in the past is that passengers arriving in Fukuoka had to wait in long lines, usually for 2 hours or longer. That was because there were so few booths where immigration officials could process visitors. The new terminal has 20 booths, and it's supposed to be able to accommodate about 3,800 passengers at one time. That's about what you would expect from a single large cruise ship. So this terminal is exactly the kind of thing that Fukuoka needs. Also, if you look at how much visitors spend in Fukuoka once they've arrived by cruise ship, Fukuoka city officials figure that spending by passengers from one ship totals about 960,000 euros, almost a million euros. And domestic cruise ship passengers currently outnumber international cruise ship passengers, but that could change. And so really what they're doing is they're making a relatively small investment in the future. In the future, what they also expect to do is to redevelop more of the waterfront area to accommodate even more ships at one time. They're also looking to clean up some of the waterfront areas that have been used mostly for industrial purposes to create things like shops and restaurants, so visitors coming by cruise ship can actually just stay in the port area rather than having to jump on buses to go into the center of Fukuoka. It's not very far, and it's actually a very attractive little city. And yet, some cruise travelers might not want to get on another bus to get into the city. They might just want to hang out locally on the port. And so that's another option that Fukuoka is developing.
Certainly somewhere to pay a visit to next time I'm cruising the high seas then. Kinji Hall, Monocle's Asia editor at large, thank you very much for joining us. Coming up next, it's time to dig into a bag of popcorn and settle in for the triumphant return of a Melbourne cinematic icon. You're listening to Asia Pack Unwrapped on Monocle 24 in association with ANZ.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly tour of the best companies, cleverest minds, and most visionary ideas in global business.
Genius is that little spark that makes us different from anybody that ever lived and anybody that ever will live.
From fashion to food, timepieces to tech, we shine light on the movers and shakers shaping the future of industry and commerce.
How do we continue to let companies grow, to enhance research, but at the same time make good decisions, make ethical decisions when we are in this world of uncertainty?
Tune in to hear how some of the smartest names in business got their start, where they went wrong, and how they turned it all around.
My goal was to brew the best ever Indian beer. Never sold a bottle of beer in my life, but that was my mission.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
Now, in the age of smart TVs, Netflix, and YouTube, one might assume that the days of an entire theatre devoting itself to one single picture at a time might be a relic of another era. The 1920s and 1930s saw enormous picture palaces sprouting up all over the world, as the advent of the talking picture made moviegoing the favourite pastime of any cultured urban dweller. But while no one would debate the architectural beauty, most cinemas outside the big box multiplex mold have struggled to adapt to modern viewing habits. However, one Melbourne landmark has a long history of bucking that trend. After more than a few threats of closure, the Astor Theatre has just found a cosy new place under the wing of Australia's Palace Cinemas. But can the majestic old picture palace really translate its eclectic blend of cinematic programming into good business sense? Well, we sent our contributor Stephen A. Russell along to sit down for a movie and a chat with the Astor's new manager, Zach Hepburn.
It's interesting when this grand old dame of cinema has had, you know, a few near misses with closures and, you know, a very uncertain future. I think one of the main reasons that Palace Cinemas, the Zekla family and myself were so keen to continue the legacy of a location is its importance in this day and age of cherishing cinema and showcasing classic cinema and iconic cinema in the way it was meant to be seen in this sort of day and age of VOD platforms, home entertainment. Being able to see, you know, a classic film on, you know, the largest screen possible in a single screen auditorium really has an air of prestige about it, and it honours the film work. So I think, you know, if you're a lover of cinema, being able to be engaged with the single screen location is really important. And I think that's one of the main reasons that everyone wanted to be involved with the saving of a location, was to preserve that legacy, because, you know, we are really one of the last single screen locations in the Southern Hemisphere that presents film on film.
I mean, it really is something worth saving. I think many would agree. But is it also good business sense in this day and age when we're more used to seeing stories of cinemas closing Greater Union in the middle of Melbourne as currently a hole in the ground? And also Palace Cinemas have the Como just down the road. So tell me a little bit about that too.
You know, I think in any sort of cinema landscape, everyone's looking for a point of difference. And you can't get more different than, you know, an over 1,000 seat auditorium that's running 70mm film, 35mm film, and classic double features. So I think from my perspective, being the manager and doing the program, the point of difference really makes sense to offer to the Melbourne landscape. But for me, this is an event location. It's a destination cinema. You go there not just to see what's on every day. It's like you walk in and go, oh, this is on, I'm going to see that. These are films that have got a real important part in people's lives, or could potentially play a real important part of people's lives. You know, everyone has an Astor story. Everyone you speak to, oh, I saw that film there, or I met that person there at that film. And that's the sort of thing I think is really vital to the landscape. You know, a lot of cinemas nowadays can just sort of be like, you know, any town in USA. I think the real kind of business model here is to have a venue that has personality, has a unique stamp, and provides a really different outlet for patrons to see cinema in a different form.
And one of the things you kind of touched on there, the joy of the Astor, is the double bill. Now, this is your first, you know, program. Tell me a little bit about how you approach that model and what you've brought to it.
Yeah, I mean, I've been doing film programming for various, you know, events and locations for some time now. I started a repertory cinema program when I was working at the Palace Westgarth some years ago. For this first program, I really wanted to sort of touch on what I think is almost like the Astor canon of films. You know, there's certain titles that are like hallowed turf here. Kenneth Branagh's Hamlet in 70mm, Baraka in 70mm, Ben-Hur. Stuff like the Blues Brothers, Rocky Horror Picture Show, which will be coming on future calendars. They're really kind of intrinsic to the location. So mapping those out, looking at what's come before, you don't want to repeat yourself all the time, and also bringing in a little bit of new flair for certain titles that, you know, maybe weren't available in 35, and we've been able to access very, you know, highly coveted digital copies from overseas. So it's all about sort of getting that balance. You know, Sunday afternoon has a very different feel to Friday night. So getting that sort of feel and tapping into the zeitgeist of the audience on any given night is really important. So, and then too, with any rep cinema, it's always important to see what the material's like. So, you know, you look at what films you can get on 35mm, what films you can get on 70mm, what films you can get in high-end digital, and then you just sort of map it out. It's like a giant jigsaw puzzle of, you know, it's film school on a sheet is the way to look at it, in a way.
Stephen A. Russell there, enjoying a classic film at the beautiful old Astor Theatre in Melbourne. And that brings us to the end of this edition of Asia Pac Unwrapped in association with ANZ. The show is produced by our studios in Hong Kong, Tokyo, and Singapore, and by me, Ben Ryland, right here at Midori House in London. Our editor, as always, was the very busy Nina Norick. Asia Pac Unwrapped is back at the same time next week. That's 7 a.m. Monday in Sydney, 9 a.m. in Wellington, and 2200 hours on Sunday here in London. Listen again and find out more at monocle.com, or tune in via iTunes, SoundCloud, or the nifty little Monocle app. This is Asia Pac Unwrapped on Monocle 24 in association with ANZ. Until next time, I'm Ben Ryland. Enjoy your week.